just going outside, you're exerting independence by leaving the building. The air is different. The temperature is different. The fragrances are different. You're able to change your world.
At Home with Growing Older is a nonprofit organization which believes in peer learning and creating discussions which bring the lens of aging to a variety of topics. At Home with Growing Older is proud to be your host of At Home on Air, a radio hour offering connection, community, and knowledge to our participants remotely. Now, we invite you to listen and learn from this live recorded episode of At Home on Air.
Welcome to At Home on Air. I'm Susie Stadler, the Executive Director of At Home with Growing Older and the producer of this podcast. At Home on Air is a forum to explore the work it takes to be at home with growing older, but also the delight which can come from doing this work. These explorations are made possible through the insights of inspiring guests from the arts, architecture, construction, medicine, social services, and beyond, and through comments and questions from you, our listeners. So thank you. In this season of At Home on Air, we are inviting community builders and placemakers to discuss their vital role in keeping us healthy and connected to our homes, shared spaces, and the world around us. In this episode, we welcome Dr. Susan Rodack, professor, researcher, architect, author of numerous books. Welcome, Susan, and thank you for dedicating your career to nature's therapeutic effects on our health and well-being. The session is hosted and moderated by Rachel Friedman, a passionate board member and psychologist. Thank you, Rachel, for hosting today's session. And we are dedicating this episode and conversation to Professor Claire Cooper-Marcus, who passed away within the last month at the age of 91. She dedicated her career and life's work to how environments can be designed to support healing and well-being. Professor Marcus was the first person to do research on the healing effects of gardens around the world, and she wrote the seminal book, Therapeutic Landscapes. Professor Cooper-Marcus was also an ardent supporter of our work to the very end. Thank you, Claire. Now to you, Rachel.
Thank you so much, Susie. I wanted to start by saying a word about why I was so drawn to Dr. Rodack's work and why I think it's so important. Intuitively, we all know that it feels comforting or relaxing to stand at the foot of the ocean or in the middle of a forest. That's because as we've evolved over millions of years, our bodies have become adapted to nature, so we automatically synchronize with the natural environment. But a growing body of scientific research now supports this seemingly obvious understanding that being in the natural world impacts our health in a very significant way. Our nonprofit, At Home with Growing Older, puts a lot of effort into thinking about the factors that support us to grow older with vitality and in robust health in our homes and in our communities. And Dr. Rodack's work helps us to understand that when we imagine being or feeling at home in our older years, we should take into consideration the natural world around us and the green spaces that connect us to each other. So this is not just a soft idea or an inconsequential one. It's really about taking seriously a powerful tool for illness prevention and happiness as we grow older.
Beautiful.
So to begin, Dr. Rodack, I'm wondering if you can tell us who or what influenced you early on to focus on this line of work.
Thank you, Rachel. I've been interested in aging since I was in my early 20s, and I was a hippie living up in the mountains of Arizona. I thought about what it would be like to be much later in life and have spent my whole life getting better and better at doing things and having more resources. And then at a certain point, it seemed to reach a tipping point. I thought maybe there could be something done about that. So much later in my life, I got interested in aging and design for aging. At that time, I was living in the Chiricahua Mountains in a little town called Paradise with 11 residents. So it was really a beautiful nature place, and I spent my whole day, every day outdoors. And Rachel, what you said is so true. People really do respond intuitively to nature. Almost everyone I've ever met seems to have an intuitive response. Interestingly enough, over the years, I've gone to different conferences and done presentations on different aspects of this topic. And invariably, someone raises their hand and said, "Yes, but what about people from urban environments?" And so we actually, in one large study we did, we collected whether people grew up or lived in an urban environment, suburban, small town, rural, etc. And we found pretty much equal interest in nature. And I've never had anyone say, "Well, I'm from a city, I don't really need nature." I think people in a city get it in different ways. I did my master's degree and my doctoral degree both on this topic. All the research I've done has mostly been on this topic, on how people can access nature in different ways, especially by going outdoors or having a door open, just being right outside their door and patio, taking a walk, whatever.
One of the things that really stuck with me that you said in an earlier conversation was about how you felt like early on in your studies, the fields of architecture and design, there was a dehumanizing aspect about it. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I studied architecture right out of high school at Cooper Union in New York City, which is a really avant-garde school. And so all anyone was interested in is pushing the envelope. There was really not much concern for let's create buildings that people feel good in, can function well in. It was all about how outrageous can you get. And how artistic can you get? I have to say, it really turned me off. And I left after a year and a half. I took a leave of absence, then I went traveling in Europe and never came back. Many, many years later, decades later, I got back into architecture, completed my degree, got a PhD, and taught architecture for 20 years. So the trigger was a really important book called Pattern Language by Christopher Alexander. It's really a pivotal book because it's all about how people use space functionally and how they feel in space. I had some good influences that brought me back into the field. Since then, in the last 20, 30 years, there's been huge movement towards what Claire said it best in one of her books, the best book title I've ever heard, Housing as If People Mattered.
Right. And her work really brought in the spiritual dimension and the psychological dimension of how we feel in certain spaces. So you mentioned that there's a lot more attention to this field now, this area of study. And I'm noticing too that it seems like everywhere I turn, there's some talk of either nature therapy or horticulture therapy or therapeutic design or forest bathing. I was just reading a book about the Japanese art of forest bathing. And then in the New York Times recently, there was an article about a head of Google who built a home in Sea Ranch and was using the concepts of neuroaesthetics. This seems to be more and more in our general parlance. And I'm wondering what you think about all of that. Are they all referring to generally the same thing? And is this a sea change? Is this a new positive shift?
I think it does indicate a sea change towards taking nature seriously. There was a very mechanical, mechanistic period, perhaps. Things come in phases, and certainly architecture was very mechanical at one point. Even human values as being part of nature was not taken as seriously. It was just a frill. But there's been, I think, a strong pushback against that from many people. I love the diversity of what people are doing in their own fields with nature and how do we explore or celebrate or utilize whatever it happens to be, our connection with the natural world. You have a really important book called The Biophilia Hypothesis by several leading researchers. It was partly research and partly a very disciplined theory about how the human spirit evolved, human beings evolved in the natural world. And ultimately, if you see something that's really close to a healthy form of nature, a survival oriented form of nature, it makes you feel more relaxed. Whereas if you're standing with concrete walls on both sides of you, looking straight up, you might not feel as good. Your blood pressure might be higher. Your mood might change to one of anxiety.
It's a good segue to talk about Roger
Yes.
Ulrich's work, which was maybe a turning point in this arena.
He published a really seminal study, View Through a Window May Influence Recovery from Surgery. And that's probably one of the most cited studies in the world. After gallbladder surgery, they're randomly assigned to whatever room is open. It might be the north side of the wing or the south side. One side had views of plants and trees, the other side had a view of a brick wall. The people with the nature view recovered faster. They needed less strong pain medications. So it's kind of incontrovertible. There was nothing else different about the people, all the same surgeons, et cetera. And there have been a lot of studies since then finding tangible, measurable benefits.
A follow-up study, if my memory's correct, people healed better in the hospital when they had even photographs of nature, even a picture of nature.
Photographs or fairly realistic representational paintings of nature are good too. Roger had done one study where when you wake up from surgery, at the foot of your bed, there either is a blank piece of cardboard or there's a nature image or there could be an abstract art image. And I think abstract art was pretty much uniformly not preferred by anyone in any of the studies he did. And there's an interesting principle that he explored that I've not seen written about many places. I've seen him do some presentations on it. For example, in a mental institution or a cancer ward, the people have anxiety and they have all kinds of mental and emotional stresses. And they are the people who least prefer abstract art. But the hospital board is composed of healthy people in their prime. They have energy. They often choose the abstract art for their hallways. And there have been instances where people in a psychiatric ward would literally attack the abstract paintings. Or if they were looking out on a courtyard with abstract sculpture, they would close their blinds. Even though it was intended to represent nature, it didn't do it in a clear-cut way. So the mind that's filled with anxiety interprets it negatively. It's got to be unambiguous. It's got to be clear cut. The worst situation was they had a whale, an abstract sculpture of a whale, and only the back half was sticking out of the courtyard because they thought, well, this is nature, you know. And when people looked at it, they said it was being buried by the earth. If you can interpret it badly, you're more likely to when you're not feeling well.
When you're not feeling well, that's fascinating. What are some of the other health effects? I know that there's many, but what are some of the other health effects of being in nature?
I've looked at nature in different types of settings, but most of my research was in assisted living and with older people because I thought in assisted living, a lot of people can go outdoors without help. And so it seemed like a really good place to focus. If you think about the fact that just going outside, you're exerting independence by leaving the building, the air is different, the temperature is different. The fragrances are different. You're able to change your world. Just the simple physical activity of walking out to a courtyard, maybe sitting down for 5 minutes and turning around and coming back in, that's really beneficial. Social interaction has, in some studies, been found to be increased where better outdoor access is improved. Brighter light helps dispel depression. If you get sunlight, you get some vitamin D. If you get more exercise, you get better calcium absorption.
And
Yep.
in today's world, when stress-related diseases are heightened and are such a global social problem, there's a lot of talk about nervous system regulation and nature helping to regulate your nervous system and reduce cortisol levels and lower blood pressure.
Yeah, I think it's pretty generally found. They've done studies where people exercise indoors versus exercising outdoors, and they find better results exercising outdoors. The little cortisol study I did, which was small, still had very strong results because not only did we find lower cortisol in people who went outdoors, but we found better mood and less depression. We used standardized inventory scales for those.
Well, I spent a little bit of time working in a nursing home. Actually, it was an independent living facility. There was a beautiful courtyard that I'm sure they spent a lot of time and money to make beautiful, and it was almost never used, which leads me to ask about your concept of barriers and magnets.
It's really classic. Before looking at design elements, a lot of people simply have the objection, but what if it's dark outside? What if it's too cold? What if it's too hot? Obviously, you can mitigate some of those things by creating a space that has lighting or maybe a radiant heater or a fan. But aside from basic climate, which you can do a little bit about, the way buildings are designed is often such an obstacle course to going out. We published a paper called You Can't Get There From Here, and it's about access to the outdoors in long-term care and how many barriers there are. The door is really hard to open often. The threshold is high. Even if you're walking, you could trip on it. But if you've got a walker or wheelchair or power scooter, you can really get into trouble there. If you imagine yourself that person, maybe 30 years from now, any of us could be there and feel frail, but you see something beautiful. It's a sunny day. You want to go out. But when you try to go out, one thing after another causes a problem. A lot of it is at the doorway. It's just not worth it to go out when those obstacles are there, but they can be almost all fixed very easily.
One of the things Claire talked about when I saw her present was a black floor mat or a black entry mat at the threshold of the door looked to a lot of people who have vision difficulties like a black hole. Removing dark doormats made it more inviting for people to be outdoors.
We built this house about 5 years ago as sort of a forever home, and it's fully accessible. We have a big patio door that goes out onto a level concrete terrace, level with the house. And we have a rug outside it, which is absolutely flat. You couldn't trip on it if you tried. It's a large one. And inside, we have a bamboo mat that's absolutely flat, and they're the same color. So it kind of gives a feeling that the outdoors is inside. You're outside and you see this very nice rug. You're inside and you see this white bamboo coming towards you, this brightness. A lot of things are aesthetic, but a lot of them are functional.
Yeah, and I know you talk about transition zones too. So bringing the outdoors in and softening that transition.
That's one of the issues in long-term care because, say, if you're living in a place that you have a wonderful room or little apartment, but there's hallways, and the hallways are for moving through. You don't sit in the hallway. You have a doorway that goes out, and you look out there and you think it looks really nice, but you're not sure if it's cold or windy or too hot. Is anyone out there? Would I be out there alone? If you put some chairs nearby and make that door perhaps in a little alcove, and then it becomes a seating alcove where you can go and sit and linger a moment. And after you look outdoors for a few moments, you say, why not? And you open the door to go out. You almost have to make it
It's
effortless.
like an invitation, yeah.
And when you get outside, what if you're just standing there with walls on both sides and concrete in front of you? You have to make a transition zone or seating area right outside the door. so they can walk out and say, oh, I've been losing my balance lately. And then they have a place to sit or lean or linger until they decide to go further. So making it effortless is important. And this can be in your own home, not only in a long-term care setting.
That reminds me about the tool that you created, the SOS tool, Senior Outdoor Survey. And if you can tell us what the tool is, why it's important, and then maybe if there's time, I can ask you about my favorite question.
Okay. All right. Well, I actually printed off a copy a few minutes ago. It's on our website. It's just 2 pages of questions that you fill in. It takes about 10 minutes to evaluate a space, say an outdoor patio at long-term care or your own terrace or patio at your home. It asks you things about the greenery, safety, paving, seating, the doorway interface, and whether you're connected to the world beyond. That's especially important once you move into an institution. But you know what? The other tool, this is a tool that's on our website for free. We had produced a three-part set of videos, and now they've been out about 10 years, and we went ahead and put them all on YouTube so you can go watch. It's almost a complete education from my perspective of what I learned over many years of why nature's important for older people and how to design the indoor spaces and the outdoor spaces to maximize usage.
It really walks people through ideas of how to do it where they live.
Yeah, each one of the videos is about 25 minutes. And when you watch the three, you pretty much know everything I know. You have the whole picture of it. And then the SOS tool helps you evaluate a particular place. If you go somewhere and they're not using it, say your mother is in a place that she's never going out, why? And this tool can help you see why.
One of the questions in your SOS tool talks about active spaces versus passive spaces, but I think it's really fascinating that you might think that the place people want to be is in the quiet garden in the back in the trees where there's no noise. And actually, where people often want to be is in the foyer or in the entryway or on the sidewalk, watching people come and go. That just seems to be something that we all desire.
Most younger people, we go to school, then we have jobs, maybe we have kids, we have neighbors, we might have volunteer activities, or we go to a gym or something like that. But when people move into a facility, that's it. I've met people who have not left that facility in 2 years, or possibly they get taken in a bus to the mall. They do an hour of mall walking and they come back. But they're just sitting there with all the same staff, the same residents in the same environment that's static. And just watching the UPS person coming and delivering packages, and he's juggling them, he's trying to get the door open. It's fun to watch people come and go. Whenever you visit a long-term care setting, you often see many or most of the residents up front. They hang out up there. I was at one in a little town in Texas where Texas A&M University is, and the new owners, managers, decided this gave a bad impression. So they took away all the seating from the whole front lobby, because they just didn't want it to look like the people were desperate. You can't fool human nature. People want what they want.
Yeah, and we want to be involved in people watching and seeing the action. We don't necessarily want to be in the back.
You're thinking of that story. It might have been Victor Rainier or John Zeisel, and they had a nursing home right next to a busy street. And they said, we'll make a quiet courtyard in the back where they can be safe and quiet. And so every day in the afternoon, the people would drag these lightweight aluminum chairs around to the front so they could watch people walk past. It was funny.
It was the same at the place where I worked. People would just drag the chairs in the front. As I get older myself, I notice the calming effect of nature even more. It's like I experience it as medicine in lots of ways. I'm just curious, Do you think that there's something that changes from a developmental point of view that changes our experience of being in nature as we get older? Are we more drawn to nature as we age? Do we appreciate it more? Maybe we hear and see things differently, and our perspective is more broadened so that we're less focused on ourselves and more on the world around us.
It's certainly possible. To tell you the honest truth, when I started working on my master's thesis with this topic, I wasn't sure that it was a fruitful topic. I did a bunch of focus groups in long-term care settings. I would start with the doubting Thomas, the question where you say, now, I assume that maybe a lot of you have had enough of nature, mosquitoes, it's too hot, it's too cold, it's muddy. And maybe by this point in life, you've already had enough of nature and you want to sit inside and watch some good TV. And people literally pounded their fists on the table saying, no, we need it more than anyone else. That was the first focus group I ever did. It convinced me. But I think it does change throughout life. Vulnerability. That's not what you're talking about specifically, but I've had nursing home directors tell me that this is in Texas, Central Texas. Older people can't tolerate wind. Even on a hot day, they don't want to be in wind. There is more physical vulnerability, but I think the spirituality becomes very strong too. A lot of the quotes from early focus groups, I typed up in big letters and put them up on the wall one time and probably my first ever conference poster presentation. And they talked about, I see the moon and the moon sees me, and all kinds of spiritual things. That's God's face more than anything else. They had deep, different, unique feelings, different people.
Maybe we interpret it differently as we get older, the meaning of nature in our lives.
We certainly know we can be deprived of it. How many people have worked in a job where you're stuck indoors even on beautiful days?
I'm very inspired by your work. I mentioned that I was reading a book about forest bathing in Japan, and I read that there are currently more than 60 official forest therapy trails in Japan, and that there's a growing number of doctors who are certified in forest medicine, and that being in
That's
nature
cool.
and walking on these trails is prescribed. And I think that your work is helping us get there. So thank you.
You're welcome. By the way, horticultural therapy is taken very seriously in Japan. A good friend of mine started the Japan Dementia Prevention Society 8 or 10 years ago. It's got well over 1,000 members now, and he's a medical doctor. He runs a big geriatric hospital in Kitakyushu, Japan. He is a horticultural therapist, licensed, and he engages it all the time with the people in his communities. It's serious business there. We don't take it as seriously here yet.
You are listening to At Home on Air. We are now switching to questions by participating audience members in this recorded live episode. If you want a chance to ask your question, visit us at athomewithgrowingolder.org and register for the next live episode.
Thank you both. Let's see what the audience has shared. So Candice says, I have an uncorroborated theory that the farther we are removed from nature, the more violent a community can become. There's such distance between the concrete jungles we live in and the solace of nature. What are your thoughts, Susan?
It brings to mind a study done in some low-income housing projects in the Midwest. They had a study that had courtyards with trees and courtyards without trees. And it was amazing. Everything else was identical, the buildings, the apartments, the courtyards. But in some, the trees hadn't survived and they were never replaced. Others, you know, had some greenery. And there was a lot less violence in the people living around the courtyards with greenery. Simple thing.
Yes. And Amy says, last year we purchased a really good two burner hot plate, and weather permitting, bring out a cutting board, veggies, and cook and eat meals in our very small yard.
In Scandinavia, in the long-term care settings, they eat all the meals outdoors when they can. And the older people, even those with dementia, help chop the wood and prepare the food. Sometimes people can't carry on a logical, intellectual conversation, but they can shell peas and they can cut food and clean mushrooms and things like that.
Being able to participate is a big deal. It gives purpose. Yeah. Adrienne says, I find myself migrating in my house, kind of following the sun. Maybe this is also something people seek.
It definitely is. I'm in the Pacific Northwest, so we do get a lot of dark weather. I took a corner of our farmhouse kitchen. It's about 5 feet by 5 feet, and it really wasn't used. I put all these bright lights up overhead. So there's three very large tomato plants there. All five that I started from cuttings when I was getting those in the pots, they all now have become large and they're all covered with flowers and fruit. We just did that this year as a way of bringing the sunshine indoors. These tomato plants are almost 2 years old, the three big ones. And I didn't want to just let them die when it got cold. So we put 15 really bright 4-foot-long light bulbs up above, grow lights that are full spectrum, yellowish white and white combined. So it makes a nice light. It's very much like daylight. I'm building light boxes at the side, but in the morning when it's gray, we can just sit there next to it and have our coffee. And it's really like being outdoors when you're not going to be outdoors here in December, January necessarily.
That's a wonderful idea and inspiration, and reminds me also our work in single room occupancy hotels in San Francisco, where some of the residents filled their rooms with plants, and some of them have also bought grow lights. I'm sure for the same reason, because there's really not much green in the San Francisco Tenderloin where these SROs are. Nature into the home like this really makes a difference.
Can do it anywhere, practically anywhere. You could add some plants and add some bright light.
Yes, and Donna says, doesn't gardening provide some of the same connection to nature? And I think you have answered this question. Yes, gardening does provide this connection.
Still trying to get some boxes in there for arugula and wintercress. And I've got two huge basil plants in the back of the house under a skylight with grow lights. And just going in there to see how your plants are doing. Rachel, you had asked me what studies showed that contact with nature actually improves longevity. And there's a fabulous study years ago in the late 70s. Two psychologists did a study in a nursing home, very controlled. They randomly divided the residents to either receive a plant, an indoor plant that they could take care of themselves, they were in charge of it, or the same plant that the staff were going to take care of. Other ones didn't receive a plant, they received another small object. And they tracked that for 18 months. And after only 6 months, the people who had a plant did better than the ones without a plant. The interesting thing was, if they were told it depended on them, for them to take care of it, those people really thrived and they had better health, more social interaction, and there were many more of them alive after 18 months. I don't know any other study since that's shown longevity that way.
I have walked into numerous care facilities where the plants have been plastic.
It's in the corner of a lobby or something that might be different, but I think the difference is, imagine if you have a plant in your room and the staff say, no, don't worry about it. We'll take care of it. You're not engaged. So the question about gardening, if you give something to that plant, your life is meaningful. You have something to contribute.
So Amy also says that we have also found a fragrance diffuser and nature sound generator and good nature videos on YouTube that can be really soothing.
Yeah, that's true. I co-authored a study with a woman from Japan who looked at that very thing of fragrance. It's a very big topic in Japan right now. And she looked at cedar and ume plum. Our paper was about ume plum, but they literally have electrodes all over someone's head and they have concentrated botanical essence. So it's in purified water. So they know that that's what they're smelling compared to a different essence compared to just pure water. And they're definitely parts of the brain stimulated in a good way by different trees. And as people have thought for years, different fragrances really do have different impacts on the brain. So that was a big surprise to me that it really is scientific.
And it's so interesting to me that there are all these different ways to access aspects of nature, from sound to smell to air to actual plants. It's pretty amazing. And Alex also contributes. He says in Japan, men who retire often take up bonsai or growing extraordinary chrysanthemums.
Very true. A doctoral student who some of you may have heard of, she was a doctoral student with me, but she's a very highly advanced person in this field, is Dr. Naomi Sachs, Sachs. She started the Therapeutic Landscapes Network 15 or 20 years ago. So you can go online and find that. In her doctoral study, she came across a study that there are things you can't consciously smell that have a huge impact on your own hormones. And it's like a pheromone. I think we all know about pheromones with bees and dogs and cats and things like that. But healthy plant materials give off certain pheromones that it's clearly found to affect our own hormones. There's no question about it. It's not, yes, maybe I feel a little better. It's measurable. So you might contact her about that. I suggested she might be a candidate for this series.
Didn't she also co-author the book Therapeutic Landscapes with Claire Cooper Marcus?
Which is really a marvelous resource.
One of the things which would be sort of a wonderful vision for the future, and I think you also mentioned it, Susan, that since it has been proven how powerful of a contributor to health it is, if doctors could actually prescribe nature.
Like they do in Japan, and I think that they even do in Scandinavia. That's the only culture I'm very familiar with that has something like burnout at work is taken very seriously. Here we might suspect, well, they're just tired, they don't want to work, but they're literally given a prescription. And there's a wonderful woman named Yvonne Westerborg who designed one of the best outdoor gardens at nursing homes that I have ever seen. It's in Stockholm. It's called Sinnenäs Trädgård, Garden of the Senses. I actually had the pleasure of taking Claire there one time after her first book was published. And she said, if I had seen this, this would have been one of the feature places in my book. This woman designed so much tactile experience. There's old fruit trees, there's wild daisies, and you'd see a staff member pushing someone along in a wheelchair, and they're reaching over and picking daisies by hand, and water features with sound, and they can reach and touch them. Plants high enough that they can smell them without bending down to the sidewalk.
What is
But
it called again?
Sinnenäs Trädgård, Senses Garden. But this woman is also, after she did that, her next job was, and I think it was government sponsored, creating restful environments. I visited a huge greenhouse there. I mean, 15 feet tall, trees, bananas, tomatoes, everything growing. And then an area with soft gravel and luxurious lounges with like fur covers, not fur, but something fluffy and soft. This is for PTSD and burnout. They have words for burnout in every other language because, or actually, they use the American word because it's taken seriously. So it's the therapy that you might need in the middle of your life, not only when you're older.
Sounds like a key is that that's accessible to all people who need it, not just by going to the spa at the Four Seasons. It's built into
Yes.
the culture. And what a world it would be if that were the case here, if cities designed that way and if housing was designed with that in mind.
I think it's coming. It might be slow coming, but I think things are moving in that direction.
Yes, I am optimistic too, especially when I listen to you, Susan. Susan, do you have anything you want to send us on the way with?
When we talked a week or so ago about what people can do. And I think basically, no matter where you live, you can bring nature indoors with green spaces, put your seating near the window, change the window coverings, and then make it more comfortable and safe outdoors and more magnetic, more of a destination. We often design houses like the house we grew up in. Or the houses that are in our neighborhood, we don't think about changing them. But you can do a lot with even things like little radiant heaters outdoors. We have one that enables us to sit out on a cold, sunny day. And I bought it because the photo showing it, someone had a garden hose that they were spraying it with. And I figured if that worked, we could use it. It's just a little thing down low by your ankles, maybe 3 feet high and all the way to the ground. Little things you can do to go outdoors, or what Rachel is doing. She's got an interesting project in her neighborhood to try to see what can be done to create more of a community park or community walking areas.
I mean, really. The city approached our neighborhood asking what people thought about putting a playground in a green space right near my house. And I proposed to the city that they make it a space for all ages. You know, why not? Because the same sort of space that's going to be accessible and benefit an older adult, even with a walker or wheelchair, is the same type of space that would benefit all people. I think we think about a park and a play structure and a playground, and we're just not used to thinking about how to conserve the needs of our whole community. My little neighborhood has one of the highest percentage of older adults in the nation. And so it seems perfectly fitting to think about attending to the needs of that group as
Yeah.
well as it relates to being in nature.
Good point. That's a wonderful idea. You're right, for safety. Also, the more people use a park, the more safe it is for everyone. When you go to the council meeting, bring a lot of older neighbors with you and they'll help make the case. I
Yes.
think we mentioned that study in Tokyo where they looked at the closer you live to a usable, accessible green space, the healthier you are and the longer you live. It was a major study about 10, 12 years ago, and they controlled for socioeconomic factors, education, everything. And they still found that proximity to a park made you healthier.
We're going to end this beautiful conversation. Bravo, Rachel. Bravo, Susan. And we really appreciate everybody who has listened and contributed. We also would like to thank everybody who donated to make this conversation possible. And you can donate and help us to continue this. We do this all on a shoestring budget. And we really are grateful to people like Susan who contribute their time. So, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Susan. So grateful for your work.
Thank you all for being here and your interest in this topic. Everyone's success with your nature quest.
Yes, quest for nature. Thank you.
This episode of At Home On Air was produced by the At Home with Growing Older team. We could not host these conversations without the generosity of our marvelous and passionate guests and hosts. Thank you for sharing your personal and professional insights. Thank you to our live audience for your thoughtful contributions. To subscribe to this podcast and for more information, visit us at homewithgrowingolder.org. At Home with Growing Older strives to educate, inspire, and connect people across generations and disciplines to re-envision and improve the experiences of later life. Don't forget to subscribe and tune in for the next episode.